Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Michael Pappas. I'm the Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council and a member of our city's Human Rights Commission. I'll be your moderator for today's program entitled Waging Peace: Why Genocide Keeps Happening. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite all to visit us online at www.commonwealth.org. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker. And I have to tell you, I had a very long biography that I had every intention of reading, but no sooner did I come here than our speaker said, let's focus on genocide and not on me. So I've had to take an editorial pen to this beautiful biography, but I'm going to give you the salient points. Rebecca Tinsley is a journalist and a human rights activist who has worked in 9 African countries. She founded Waging Peace, a London-based group campaigning on Darfur, and Network for Africa, a charity working with survivors of genocide after the big aid agencies move elsewhere. Together with her husband, Henry, she was asked by President and Mrs. Carter to start the Carter Center, UK. Rebecca completed a law degree at the London School of Economics. She is a former BBC reporter, stood for election twice for the UK Parliament. She is the author of a number of articles in many distinguished publications, both in England and throughout the world. And as was mentioned earlier, is the author of her third novel, When the Stars Fall to Earth, and it's based on interviews with all of the courageous survivors of genocide in Darfur. And as was mentioned, all of the proceeds from her books are donated to Darfur refugee rescue efforts. So without further ado, we welcome Rebecca Tinsley. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much for turning up. First of all, thank you to Celia, and thank you to Michael. And thank you to you for turning up to hear an obscure and unknown woman talk about a subject that is genocide and therefore doesn't appeal to an enormous amount of people on a Friday afternoon. Let's start with a definition of genocide. The 1948 Genocide Convention defines it as the intent to destroy in whole or in part a group depending on their religion, their race, their ethnicity, their sexuality. In summary, what I'm going to talk about is how I believe that committing genocide is part of human nature rather than an aberration. And I think the problem, and why we don't react, we being the international community, don't react, is because we treat it as an aberration, and therefore we're surprised when it happens, whereas I think it's a fundamental part of human nature and that we should plan accordingly. I'm then going to talk about the big issues, how we might, on a global scale, deal with genocide, and then a much smaller picture, which is how I, in my admittedly very modest, small way, am trying to help people who have survived genocide. And I realize that people will want to ask questions and make comments and talk, so I am going to try and race through all the points that I have to make as quickly as possible. Let's start, though, with my basic assertion. I don't think that, you know people who say, I'm a good person. Well, I would disagree. You're a person. You know, we are all made up of good and bad instincts, and surely the path of our life is choosing between the bad and the good voices in our heads. And that is what makes us such rather interesting critters, isn't it? I believe that it is wrong to say that it is Germans or Africans who commit genocide. It is people, given the right circumstances. We are all capable of committing genocide. And until the decision makers in our world understand that and grasp that, genocide is going to keep happening. Unfortunately, there, and you know, how do I know that? It is predictable. First of all, the minute that a leader starts describing a minority using words that are not either person or human, you know that you have genocide on the way. Look through history. There is a pattern to how this happens. The first is the dehumanization of people using manipulation, propaganda, regarding people as inhuman, and therefore using greed, fear, conformity, and residual hatred. And that is present in a huge number of societies. And also, one that always interests me, and that is the role of intellectuals and academics behind so many of the world's genocides. And what I'm talking about is, for instance, you can see it now with Islamic State, that you have religious leaders and academics and intellectuals who are saying to bored, unemployed, frustrated young men, the hand of history is on your shoulder, you know, and we can create a caliphate. This is no different from Hitler's Greater Germany or Slobodan Milosevic's Greater Serbia. Shamefully, there were always intellectuals behind these movements who were prepared to manipulate bored young men and send them into battle to die for their twisted ideology. I also mentioned greed as being a factor, and I'm sure a lot of you know about the use of hatred and fear in provoking people to commit genocide, but I'm always stunned when I'm in Rwanda, which I go to every year because we have humanitarian projects there. I interview people who killed their next-door neighbor for a chicken or a cooking pot. I know people in Bosnia who tell me about how on a Friday evening during the Bosnian War, the Serbs, Serbian academics, Serbian doctors, intellectuals, middle-class people, would rent a vehicle, drive over the mountain to Bosnia, spend the weekend killing Bosnian Muslim men and raping Bosnian Muslim women, and then come home with their vehicle filled with microwave ovens and video recorders. Arrive home on Sunday night, honey, I'm home, look at all the things I brought you. Greed. Another example of that, of course, we saw in Nazi Germany, the number of people who betrayed their neighbors because they'd always wanted that Meissen porcelain service that the Rosenbergs next door had. And we underestimate the power of greed in all of this, in the manipulation of people. Equally dismal is the predictability of the way the international community responds when genocide starts. The first thing they do, of course, is to deny the genocidal intent or ideology, because the minute you admit genocide is happening, you have a moral and legal obligation to do something about it. So we have the absurdity during the Clinton administration, 100 days of genocide in Rwanda, and you had the linguistic gymnastics of the State Department saying, it's not genocide, it's acts of genocide. Very, very Clintonian. The other thing that happens, of course, is that they deny the scale. You may have heard of a Polish Jew called Jan Karski, who managed to escape from Nazi Germany. He made it to both Britain and America. He met both Churchill and Roosevelt and warned them about what was happening in the death camps. And in the cases of both, we now have cabinet minutes to reveal that the WASPs sitting around the room said to each other after Karski had left, well, you know the Jews, they're very emotional people, so he's probably exaggerating about what happened there. Another thing is that in the dismal pattern of the international community's reaction is that we have peace talks, endless peace talks with the architects of the genocide, fooling ourselves that these people actually want peace when they don't. They just want to waste our time with endless peace talks. One thinks of the absurdity of Bosnia, where Slobodan Milosevic, who very plainly wanted to kill all the Bosnian Muslims, he would sit around for ages in peace talks, and as they signed peace agreements, within a minute the Serbs would start shelling the very building that the peace negotiation were taking place in, so they would have to hide under the table, and still they didn't get the idea. The final thing that really annoys me is the way that the international community, and what a euphemism that is, incidentally, the way the international community portrays genocide as if it's some kind of natural disaster. And they respond with humanitarian aid rather than saying this is a political problem that deserves a political response. When I was in Darfur in 2004, at the height of the killing, I was the only journalist there. I remember interviewing a young woman called Hawa, and she said to me, you know, it's very kind of you to send the aid and the blankets and the food, but you know what? We're Africans, and we're used to dealing with not much food. What we'd actually like you to do is take the guns away from the people who are killing us. And incidentally, it is because of Hawa that I wrote my novel, When the Stars Fall to Earth. She asked me to be the voice of the women in Darfur, and I said to her, how on earth could I be the voice? I'm a privileged white woman who's never known a moment of fear or hunger in my life. And she said, with brilliant African logic, but you're here. So she burdened my heart to try to tell her story. So enough of that. If you're not convinced already that genocide, unfortunately, is part of human nature, perhaps some of you in the audience would like to volunteer what genocides you believe have happened since 1900. And then I will show you a list, a selective list of some.
Armenia.
Please speak up. Yes. Any more? That is a selective list. This is what I call my Neil Armstrong slide. And here's my point. For every act of vileness in the world, I promise you there is a corresponding act of decency and tolerance and love. And I know, given that the subject matter, you might think that's weird, but listen to this. This is Camp Dora, Nordhausen, East Germany. During the Second World War, the Nazis built the V-2 Vengeance rocket in what was an abandoned salt mine because nobody could fly overhead and see what they were doing. They worked 25,000 Russian prisoners of war to death making this V-2 rocket. And yet, 40% of those rockets didn't work because on a daily basis, the Russian prisoners sabotaged the rockets. These rockets were not aimed at Russians, so they weren't saving their families. They were saving people in Britain and Belgium who were being targeted, and yet they risked death every day to sabotage those rockets. And if you were caught sabotaging them, the Nazis would hang you from a meat hook over the entrance you can see there to that tunnel until you died, and then they let your body stay there till it rotted. So quite an incentive, really, not to sabotage, but they did. There are some of the bodies that were discovered when the camp was liberated, 25,000 Russian prisoners of war who did the right thing. I call it my Neil Armstrong slides because the SS officer who was responsible for this was called Wernher von Braun, and he arrived in America, and the American military wiped clean the slate of his resume, and he built the Saturn V rocket that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. The little girl that you can see there on the right-hand side, her name was Hilda Schramm. Her father was Albert Speer, who was Hitler's second in command. And yet she grew up to be the lady you see there on the left. She devoted her entire life to, and still does, to fighting for tolerance and decency. And that is her with two Syrian refugees in Germany who she has invited to live with her. And that is what I mean by, for every good act, I promise you there is a terrible act, and vice versa. When I talked about conformity, as one of the factors that gets people to commit genocide. I'm fascinated by this subject, the fact that we, in masses, we can lose our moral compass. And if you are as interested as I am, I've given you a few sources there of examples of how people lose their moral compass in a crowd and how you can therefore manipulate them to do unspeakable things. The other point I'm making, of course, is that committing genocide is nothing to do with intelligence. The reason I'm showing you this slide of the Wannsee Conference in 1942, this is the conference where, and I warn you, here comes another euphemism, where the Nazi high command decided on the final solution of the Jewish question. Now, the reason, there's Reinhard Heydrich up in the front. The reason that I'm showing you this is that three quarters of the people in that room had PhDs. It is nothing to do with intelligence. And I have to tell you, when I was a kid, my mother had been in the Army of Liberation in the Second World War. She was a war reporter. And when I first found out about the Holocaust, I wanted my mother to tell me that it was stupid people that did this, that it wasn't people like us, that it couldn't possibly happen in our society. But she refused to give me that comfort. And she said to me that the Nazis would kill Jews all day and then go home and listen to Beethoven and read Goethe. They were among the most educated people in the world. So let's not kid ourselves that it couldn't happen in our society as well. I interviewed, in 2004, on my first trip to Rwanda, I interviewed a professor in a prison for people who had committed genocide. And you only got put in jail in Rwanda if you had killed 100 people or more. He was one of the masterminds. And he wanted to talk to me about his favorite subject, which was Jane Austen novels. And by the way, his favorite was Pride and Prejudice, and we agreed on that. And I asked him, why did you do this? You gave up everything, and now you're in prison. He ran the English department at the university in Rwanda. I said, don't you regret it? And he said, I regret we didn't get them all, but we will next time. This slide proves that, I think it proves that black lives do not matter to the international community. Have a look at the way those numbers, see if you can see a pattern there. Of course, it's not all genocide, it's death. Now, the truth of the, and it's also about the amount of media attention that these deaths get. The horrible truth here is that the larger the number, the blacker the skin. I'll take you back there. So what can we do about this? The big picture, actually, no, I'm going to take you there. This is Rwanda. My little charity network for Africa are involved with this group called Solace Ministries, which provides a safe space for survivors of the genocide to come together to talk about their experiences. As you can see, that young woman, her name is Nadine, and she's given me permission to use her slide, her photograph, so that I can try and let people in the West know about what happened in Rwanda in the 100 days of genocide. As you can see, somebody tried to cut her head off. She was 8 years old when the genocide started. You can also see the scar near her eye. The woman with her is called Mama Lambert. She's also a survivor. She was gang raped by a group of Hutu militia. She is from the Tutsi minority. And as they were raping her, they killed her three children and her husband. She finally got a form of justice when she went to the trial of the man who killed her children and her husband. He confessed. But he said to her, I will never tell you where the bodies are buried, because I know that is how I will hurt you the most. And so Mama Lambert does not have justice or closure. And when people tell me, gosh, it's been 22 years since the Rwandan genocide, haven't they healed yet? I find myself almost without words. although occasionally if I'm in a cruel mood, I remind you guys that it's 150 years since the Civil War. How's that going? Tribal symbols and all that? This drawing is from Darfur. In 2004, as I've mentioned, I went to Darfur. I interviewed, it was at the height of the killing, I interviewed dozens of women who then asked me to go back to my world and try and be a voice for what had happened to them. And I have written loads of articles that not many people read and tried to influence decision makers. But we also collected 500 drawings by children in the refugee camps. I show you this drawing, first of all, because we submitted 500 of these drawings to the International Criminal Court, and because the Sudanese government does not allow in journalists, there is almost no photographic evidence of what has been done in Darfur. So believe it or not, the ICC has accepted our 500 drawings as evidence of the context of war crimes and genocide. So we were able to go back to the kids who drew these pictures and say to them, one day, hopefully, you will be responsible for providing the evidence that brought to justice the people who killed your father and your uncle and your brother. The second reason I show you this is because the Sudanese government denies that this is about ethnicity. The Sudanese government, basically Arab and Islamist, Sudan is the world's second Islamic state after Iran, and they are Islamist and supporters of terrorism. And they are killing black Africans. They've destroyed 90% of the black African villages in Darfur. If that isn't a genocide, I really don't know what is. But look how the children depict the color of the skin of the people who are killing them. You or I are ignorant when we look at people from Sudan because we don't know what to look for. To us, they probably look all the same. But of course, racial identity is not in your DNA. It's in how you regard yourself, how you self-identify. Those children have drawn the people killing them with light brown skin, and they have drawn the victims with black skin. And that is because when the Sudanese Arabs go in there to kill them, they use racial epithets. They brand the women like slaves while they rape them, telling them that they're diluting the blood of their ethnicity. And look at that image down in the bottom left-hand corner. That is young women, pretty young Darfuri women, being roped together by their necks. And they are taken into slavery. They're put on a plane that takes them to Khartoum, the Sudanese capital, where they are distributed among Sudanese army officers to use as they please, and they are never seen again. This is happening in the year 2016, an image from the slave trade. And nobody cares about this subject. It is incredibly hard to get anybody interested in this. Good. I'm glad you care. What do we do about this? This is the big picture that I mentioned before. There are piles of wonderful, worthy international laws. But guess what? Nobody ever enforces them because there is no political will. And part of that is because of the composition of the UN Security Council, which we can talk about in Q&A if you're interested in this. You know, there are a stack of UN resolutions on Darfur, that big, but they're not enforced. So unless you have people who are willing to enforce them, you know, they're just decoration. Military intervention, that's another option, but I think I don't need to stand here and tell you how failed military intervention has been in so many situations. One thing I will mention, though, Romeo Dallaire, who was the UN commander in Rwanda at the time of the genocide, he said, if only, he warned the UN it was going to happen. It was obvious, you know, the buildup of arms. He warned the UN that it was going to happen. And he said, please give me 5,000 soldiers so I can let the Rwandan Hutu fascists know that we have their eyes on them. And he said that really would have let them know our eyes were on them, and it might have prevented it. But of course, the UN ignored him. Another thing that I think is more interesting is using leverage, using what's called soft power. And that is making it personal to the people who are the architects of the genocide. Sanctions against a whole population don't really achieve a great deal. But think about this. Asma Assad, who is the wife of President Assad of Syria, she's on Amazon every day ordering things because there she is holed up in Damascus with no ability to get what she wants for her kids, you know, computer games or makeup or whatever she wants. And she does have a taste for Gucci handbags. Well, how astonishing that we haven't thought of freezing her bank account, freezing her credit cards, stopping her from ordering things on Amazon. The same applies to Kim Jong-un in North Korea, who has a passion for fast sports cars while his people starve to death. He you know, goes online all the time and orders luxury goods. How bizarre that we don't think of making the sanctions targeted and personal to these people, to freezing their bank accounts, to stopping them going on shopping trips to Paris or going and getting their cosmetic surgery in Switzerland. The extraordinary thing is we don't do this. And the equally extraordinary thing is that all of this has been passed in UN resolutions that are not enforced. And that's I realized ages ago that we needed to make it personal when I came back from Darfur and I was talking about what had been happening there, and the Sudanese ambassador to London was sitting in the front row. He didn't really care about me talking about babies being thrown on fires, women raped, men killed. But when I talked about targeted smart sanctions like stopping his shopping trips to Paris, he went completely ape. And that was my aha moment. We have to make this personal. But at the same time, I think that we could be using all kinds of soft power leverage, because a lot of these governments want access to international finance. They want to help with dealing with their debt. To quote your future president, there are deals to be made with these people. And there really are. You cannot underestimate the vanity of the leaders of these vile countries. They want to go to international conferences where they behave like the big guy. If we stop them from doing that, I really do believe we might actually change their behavior. And the good thing is that, I despair of the UN Security Council, but if you put together a coalition of the willing, these are countries like Canada, the USA, the Scandinavians, Australia, New Zealand, the European Union. In other words, people who care about human rights. Not coincidentally, they also happen to be economically successful countries. So they do have leverage. You know, we do have the ability to go after the accountants, the lawyers, the consultants, the PR agents who work within our society to enable genocidal dictators, and yet we don't do it. Which takes me to the small picture, which is what I personally have tried to do in my own modest and small way. I felt it wasn't enough to just write articles about a genocide that's happening right now. I thought that it might be an idea. I was so inspired by the people I met in Rwanda, their resilience, their resourcefulness, their courage, that I thought maybe it would be an idea to try to help genocide survivors rebuild their lives. And so I started a charity called Network for Africa, which is a 501c3. And since I spend my life begging for donations, I'd be grateful if any of you know multimillionaires. Please guide them to that website. But I had three rules going into this. The first was that I was never going to employ a white person to do something that a black African could do. The second rule was that I was always going to ask the people in Rwanda and Uganda, where we work, what they think the solution to the problem is. Because although what I have learned is that although people may be illiterate, it doesn't mean they're stupid. It just means they didn't get a chance to go to school. And the third thing, the little rule that we have, is that we always try to find local people to be mentors and role models, because they are far more effective than shipping in a bunch of exotic white people. Therefore, we started a program called Aspire, and 500 Rwandan genocide survivors a year, we train them in skills like cookery, hairdressing. We also teach them to read and write, women's rights. I'm very proud that 100% of our women are using family planning by the end of our 12-month course. I'm also proud that we quadruple their income, at least, at the end of the 12-month course. That's the cookery class. We encourage the women to form cooperatives rather than going out into business by themselves, because culturally it is a more cooperative society, and we feel that they can do a wonderful job supporting each other in what they do. We also, completely by accident, have ended up with 500 toddlers a day coming to our project, because, of course, if you're teaching the women, you have to do something with the kids. This has been something that I just had no idea, the transformative effect of 12 months of nutritious food and teaching children their numbers. And the result is that when these kids have come through our program and start school, elementary school, they are stronger, healthier, smarter than their peers. And I couldn't believe that you could actually transform a life with only 12 months of work, but it has been an accidental bonus. This is northern Uganda, where Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army has been slaughtering people for 20 years. You're looking at a group of former child soldiers who were all brutalized during that civil war in Uganda, often made to kill their parents or their best friend, kill or be killed. Massive post-traumatic stress disorder in northern Uganda. We found that we wanted to as we've done in Rwanda, passing on skills, literacy, that kind of thing. But people said to us, look, as long as 43%, we did a survey, 43% of the people here consider killing themselves once a week because of post-traumatic stress disorder, you're actually wasting your time trying to train us in anything. So we got a couple of delightful psychotherapists from Missouri who volunteer, who go there twice a year for 3 weeks, and they train former child soldiers to be counselors, because who better to understand? Absolutely pointless taking a bunch of white people to do this. And so we have a cascade system. We have 23 of the smartest child soldiers. They are trained as psychotherapists. We give them a bicycle. They go out into the villages where they do group therapy and individual therapy using very basic psychotherapy techniques like breathing, relaxation, visualizing a safe place. So far, we have reached 10,000 people in northern Uganda with post-traumatic stress disorder. And we do that for very little money at all. And I knew that we were getting somewhere after the first week when a woman came up to me and said, thanks to you, I have had the first decent night's sleep in 20 years. Thank you. This is also my pride and joy. There's a community of 17,000 genocide survivors, orphans, in Rwanda called Ntarama. I assumed they'd want a school, but, you know, this is why you should listen to local people. A guy said to me, well, considering that 4 out of 10 of our children die of malaria and diarrhea before they reach the age of 10, perhaps a clinic might be an idea. So we built a clinic, and the local people were so enthusiastic about it that they helped us expand it, so it is now a hospital. This is the labor, the room, the maternity room. And however lousy a day I have had, when I go to bed at night, I know that 4 or 5 Rwandan women every day will give birth in that room rather than crouching over a dirt floor, terrified of what might be about to happen. And instead of being a frightening experience, giving birth is now a joyful experience, as it should be. And how could I not want to help people who define themselves as survivors and not victims? I welcome your questions. Thank you.
We thank Rebecca Tinsley, human rights activist and author, for her comments. And we remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Waging Peace. Our speaker is Rebecca Tinsley, human rights activist. I'm Michael Pappas, today's moderator. We have many questions from the audience, so let's begin. You taunted us a little bit. And by raising the issue of the UN Security Council. Can you talk to us a little bit about its composition and why they're not doing more?
Thank you. The UN Security Council, the permanent members, are, as you know, are Russia, China, the United Kingdom, France, and the USA. The reason that the Russians and Chinese are never going to vote for any kind of intervention is that quite often there are two reasons. One, they're supplying weapons to the people committing genocide. And two, they don't want to establish a precedent, a legal precedent, for going into someone else's country in the name of international law, because, of course, in both cases, they're busy oppressing their own minorities. So as far as they're concerned, all of the existing international law matters naught, except one thing, the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, which guarantees state sovereignty, which basically means you can do anything you like to the citizens of your country. So that's Russia and China. That leaves France, the United Kingdom, and the USA. As you know, the United Kingdom is nothing more than America's poodle, which usually does what America tells it to do. And these terrible the French, of course, are a law unto themselves, quite often plowing their own fascinating and hypocritical path, supplying people with weapons and digging up the oil in these countries at the same time as lecturing everybody about freedom, equality, and liberty. Bless them. So that leaves us with Britain and America. And when it approaches, let's take an example like Sudan. The reason that nothing is going to happen there is because we prefer the devil we know. It's as simple as that. We know that monstrous Islamists are running this country, and yet we fear they may be replaced by something worse. I know this sounds absolutely bizarre, but think back, those of you who are old enough to remember the Cold War. Do you remember when we used to avert our eyes from the most monstrous regimes, and we backed them because they said, we're on your side against the red menace of the USSR? All we have to do is update that slightly to the war on terror. And so there are loads of countries that say, oh, we're on your side in this. And we literally avert our eyes because they've said they're with us. And this is our new standard of hypocrisy. And regrettably, this is why the UN Security Council is not very likely to ever take a stand against massive human rights violations. However, there is some hope in all of this. And that goes back to my Trumpism of doing deals. I'm working on that movement of his. The interesting thing is that China, if you take North Korea, China has every reason to want to contain North Korea. A friend of mine who's involved in politics in Britain, he recently went to see the Chinese ambassador about North Korea. And the Chinese ambassador said to him, you know what we think about North Korea? The neighbor from hell. And it's true. So there are deals to be done. The North Koreans will listen to the Chinese. It is up to us to subtly, diplomatically, quietly find ways of making it worthwhile for the Chinese to help us with the North Koreans. So I think there just needs to be a bit of creativity.
You raised the issue of Sudan. One of our audience members asked, regarding President Bashir of Sudan, what are the chances he can be brought to justice?
No chance whatsoever, because the entire Arab world backs him. And I should really have mentioned this when I was galloping through my presentation, but here's the thing about Darfuris. They are Muslim, but they're the wrong kind of Muslim because they're black, so they don't count. So there has been not a peep from the Muslim world about the slaughter, the mass slaughter by Muslims of Muslims in Darfur. They all hang together. Nor will the African Union criticize President Bashir of Sudan, even though he has killed literally millions of black Africans, because none of the people in the African Union, which I think should be renamed the Kleptomaniac Dictators Club, none of them actually want the spotlight of attention shone on them. And so it's a kind of mutually assured destruction thing. We're not going to criticize you if you don't criticize us. So consequently, Bashir can travel the world to selective places as he wishes. And we in the West are never going to apply pressure to him, because even though he has been a great supporter of Al-Qaeda for years, and Hamas, and Hezbollah, in fact, Khartoum in the 90s was known as the terrorist Hilton for all kinds of people like Carlos the Jackal and Osama bin Laden. But we're not going to criticize him because, as I said, we're afraid of what might replace him. And at the moment, he takes the phone calls from the State Department. And as long as our diplomats, I've literally had a guy from the State Department say this to me, as long as they're taking our phone calls, we think they're controllable.
In the aftermath of the Paris climate talks, one of our audience members asks the question, how is drought and climate change impacting those already at risk or who have no vote?
That is an extremely good question, whoever asked that. One of the factors, the contributory factors in Darfur, is that the Sahara is moving south every year, desertification, they call it, which means that the traditional Arab herders are running out of land. So they're killing the black African farmers to take their land. So it is a direct contributory factor. If you think about a map of Africa, right across the Sahel from the west to the east, there is a band of arid land. This pattern is being repeated in all of those countries, that herders, who tend to be Arab, are finding they don't have land anymore on which to graze their animals. And their governments, instead of saying, you know what, maybe you should learn how to use a computer and get with the 21st century instead of following a goat around all day, that would be too much effort. So their governments just say, why don't you just go and kill those black African farmers who tend to be agriculturalists. And you can see that pattern right across Africa, and it is being made even worse by the funding that is going into extremist groups like Boko Haram, like Al-Shabaab. And that funding, of course, comes from our great friend, the Saudi Arabians, who are our partners in the war on terror.
Imagine that. This question is posed about, is there a discussion about retribution for survivors? I'm wondering if maybe another word might be reparation for survivors. Please illustrate with an example.
Yeah, this is also a good question. In northern Uganda, I showed you the picture of our psychotherapists on bicycles. There is a whole discussion about how you welcome back a child soldier into the community after war. Because for a lot of people, it isn't so great to wake up one morning and find that the kid who killed your mother is now a grown-up and living next door and very traumatized and disturbed. And what I think I've learned by listening to local people is that we have to respect traditional methods of reconciliation. Thank you. Because it is not necessarily Western justice that is going to do the trick here. Although we may feel a need for justice, for a lot of people who've lived through 20 years of war, they want peace. And so a more traditional method, which involves rituals, I've heard of one ritual that involves people who have been child soldiers walking over eggshells. Now, this may sound absurd to you, but it doesn't matter what you think. The point is that in the African context, in the context of northern Uganda, this is a respected ritual, and it means that you bear in mind, you don't forget, but you forgive, and you try and heal and get on with your life.
You just spoke of peace and unity. This question is, what impact could the proposed Pan-African highway have on the African dream of peace and unity?
It'll be something that, it's another good question, but I have a feeling that that is something that will benefit the hyper-rich elite in many, many African countries because of corruption, because first of all, the building of it will be highly corrupt and will benefit the people who are the cronies of the people running these countries. But secondly, if you're stuck on an obscure farm in the middle of nowhere in Africa, you're really not going to benefit from this highway. And these are the dreams that the international humanitarian aid people get very excited about these projects. To me, it's more meaningful to build a well so that people can have clean water. It's more meaningful to bring in very low-cost solutions to diarrhea and malaria if you actually want to help African people. I remember this example in Rwanda. The president very, very proudly said, we are going to join the 21st century. We're going to be the Singapore of Africa. We're putting down fiber optic cable all over the country, and it's going to be fantastic. He ignored the fact, of course, that the majority of people, one, are not literate, two, have not got a computer, and therefore are not going to benefit. But God bless the Rwandans. They methodically dug up the fiber optic cable and wove it into really beautiful baskets that you can buy. That's why I love Africa. How resourceful.
As you were speaking, I couldn't help but think about the political rhetoric here in our country on issues of immigration, and I'm wondering if you see any parallels to some of that rhetoric so we can better appreciate and perhaps be more empathetic to the cause in Darfur and other areas where there is genocide.
Well, I'm a guest in your country, so it would be rude of me to draw parallels between any of your political candidates and the use of fear and hatred and incendiary language to
that
manipulate
said.
People. Obviously, I wouldn't comment on that because that's your issue. But one thing I will say about immigration, if you don't think Africa matters, one of the reasons it does matter is that because there is now an internet cafe in the most obscure parts of many African countries, people can see for themselves that we have a better life here. And people are, you know, the wave of immigration from Africa has only just started. And from my point of view, that is why it's extremely important that Africa is peaceful and prosperous, because those people will be much happier staying in their countries and building their countries if they have peace and prosperity. And if you're concerned about waves of immigrants, then it is honestly worth the effort to invest in Africa. And if you don't believe me, the Chinese will, and they're there, and they don't care about environmental impact assessments or human rights either.
Since you are a guest in our country, we'll take you to another country. This question is, can you speak to the slaughter in Syria, or is Africa your sole specialty?
Africa is my thing, but the factors behind what's happening in one of the factors behind what's happening in Darfur is, of course, Islamism. It is the view that Muslims are racially superior to black Africans, whom they call Abid to their faces. That means slave to their faces. And the Islamists point to passages in the Quran and they say, here, look what it says there. God created black people to be our slaves. And this actually informs the Islamism that we see in somewhere like Sudan. And, you know, you cannot divorce that from what is happening in Syria, where, you know, as you know, ISIS and al-Nusra take this attitude that Islamism is the answer. They prey on disillusioned, unemployed, bored young men who are looking for a purpose in their lives. It is all part of the same unpleasant pattern. And I'm going to say it again, as long as we suck up to the Saudi Arabians who are providing the funding for a huge amount of this, you know, we are cutting off our noses despite our faces.
Mm. This question is: could you mention some of the countries where atrocities like Rwanda and Cambodia are taking place?
Yeah. Well, apart from Darfur, it's also happening in the Blue Nile area of Sudan and in South Kordofan, and a genocide that is literally not covered at all. I would argue that what is happening in Syria is genocide because religious minorities are being killed as part of an ideology. In Zimbabwe, there has been genocide because President Mugabe wanted to kill one section of his population and succeeded in doing so without a squeak from the international community. There are, how long have I got? Unfortunately, it is a pattern, as I've said, and it happens. And we don't seem to intervene or care unless we have a reason. And that reason often is a three-letter word, O-I-L. And as I said, if their ruler is on our side in the war on terror, we also avert our eyes.
You've spoken about the racial discrimination. I'm wondering if there are particular sectors such as the LGBT community in Africa and other sectors that you've witnessed firsthand, and you could speak to that.
Yes, and this, again, I'm going to be a very ungracious guest in your country because some of the people wandering around Africa encouraging anti-gay rhetoric are evangelicals from America and Pentecostalists who arrive literally, I've seen this, with suitcases full of money to distribute to people to encourage them to stir up anti-gay feeling. It's almost as if it is part of their policy to do this in societies where, of course, there had been a residual caution about homosexuality, but it is part of their project to do this. And the cost is felt by lesbians in South Africa who are literally being raped and killed because they're regarded as bewitched, and by gay people, very brave people all across Africa.
Thank you. At the very outset, you spoke of human nature. This person asks, why do we find it so easy to forget the sufferings not in front of our eyes?
Oh, that's a really good question, isn't it? I suppose we're protecting ourselves, delicate little creatures that we are. Gosh, that leaves me almost speechless. We don't want unpleasantness. We prefer to think that people who are enduring this genocide, human rights abuses, are the other. I think sometimes we blame them. Well, you know, if you will live in a country like that, what do you expect? I think it's subconscious. You know that list I gave you of all the people who've died, AIDS, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the darker the color, the larger the number. I think that whether we like it or not, most of us have racism within us, and we kind of think of those victims as the other. But I would argue we're all in this together for all kinds of economic reasons, apart from anything else, and that we have no right to despair of that aspect of human nature, because the people that I have the pleasure of working with in Africa every day, they don't give up. So what right do we have to give up?
This person was very moved by the slide of the children that you put up, and actually asked if you would put it back up. And I'm guessing after the program you could do that, and asks if it would be okay to post it on Facebook.
Now, is that the children at the drawing by the children?
Thank you. Because this is being recorded, I'm in the unenviable position of having to moderate. So let me moderate. Because this is being recorded, you would like to see that image be able to be posted on Twitter and other social media because of its impact. I think that's what. Do we have permission?
Yes, you do.
Okay. That was
a
succinct answer.
The little boy who did that picture, incidentally, he was 8 years old, just to give you a bit of context.
Thank you. That's an important point. This person asked, what do you think is at the root cause of not leveraging soft power? Is it because they haven't thought about it?
If I was a cynic, which of course I'm not, I would say that the people running countries hate the idea of ever making policies personal, because they're all in a club, aren't they? They're all in the international club of leaders. And I think they loathe the idea that you set a precedent of freezing bank accounts and curbing the personal, extravagant lifestyles of these folk. So I think that's the cynical response. I think also we have a tendency in the West to either think about military intervention on this side, boots on the ground, or doing nothing. And that's our lack of imagination. As I've said, you know, we all, those of us who've lived through the last 20 years, have some questions about military intervention. But I think it's unacceptable to therefore think that you do nothing. And I just think it's a lack of imagination on our part. I think the Peterson Institute in Stockholm did a study of the effectiveness of sanctions. And they found that general sanctions, they work in about a third of occasions. Now, I would argue even general sanctions, that's not a bad idea because it's a lot cheaper than having a war. But targeted sanctions, some work is being done on this. Targeted, smart, personal sanctions that transfer the personal pain and humiliation to the architects of human rights abuses, they are being shown to be far more effective. So I regard it as the job of my job and of my friends who helped me with this to try and promote this as much as possible.
We're at that point where we have just one question left, and I'm going to take the privilege of asking that. You've spoken with such passion, and your work has really expressed itself, the passion that you have. I'm wondering, personally, what inspired you to enter into this work, and what keeps you sustained?
Well, first of all, I should say that I'm a volunteer. Again, to quote your future president, I'm self-funded. And that, therefore, I urge you to please come and look at my novel at the back of the room, because that very much helps my work.
And how could people support your work?
They could come and take my card, which is also at the back of the room. Contact me, and if you know a multimillionaire, please put me in touch with them. Why I started all of this? I was 6 years old in our garden in Toronto, and our next-door neighbor, Mrs. Lotnick, came out and was playing with me and picked me up, and her sleeve fell back, and I saw the numbers on her arm. And I went in later, and I said to my mother, why does Mrs. Lotnick have those numbers on her arm? And even though I was six, my mother was never one to sugarcoat things, so she told me exactly what had happened to all of Mrs. Lotnick's relatives in Poland and how Mrs. Lotnick herself had been only 3 days away from being killed in Auschwitz. And I can still remember being just consumed with anger about this, because it just seemed such an irrational thing. And I wanted my mother to tell me that stupid people, primitive people, did this. And this is when my mother said to me, the German soldiers, they killed Jews all day, and then they went home and they listened to Beethoven, because she wanted to shake me up and to get me to ask questions about how it is possible to manipulate someone so much that they can dehumanize their neighbor. And the path of my life has not been a straightforward one, but I've weaved around quite a lot, but it's taken me through Bosnia, Darfur, Rwanda, Uganda, and now 12 African countries. And I'm still asking the question. My mother unfortunately died when she was quite young, and I was 15. And basically, I suppose I'm trying to honor her memory and what she wanted me to do.